But we will start by, I'll just formally sort of like open the interview and say, Sarah Gavin, I remember you from Greenham and Aldermaston. And so I'd like you to just maybe talk a little bit originally, you know, about your family life, whether your parents were supportive, how your education was, and a little bit of your personal background, anything that you want to share.
Okay. No, I didn't come from a family that supported anything that I believed in at all. I was pretty much alone. I learned about Greenham very early on because I was involved in quite a lot of women's feminist stuff in Ireland. So, you know, people were coming back and forth bringing us information, but I hadn't actually gone. At that time, I was busy with raising my small children. And so I wasn't able to go at that point. And then when I first went to Greenham was in 1989, when I went to live in England, in London. So that was the first time I actually went to Greenham. That was it. That was my first time. Yeah, so at the start when I went, I was able to spend quite a bit of time because I just arrived and I hadn't got a job yet. So I spent quite a lot of time at Greenham. And then when I started to work, I went there at weekends. So most weekends.
Right. So what gate? Did you have any particular
I
gate?
I went to Blue Gate, mainly because that's where I usually slept. I sort of parked my vehicle up there and slept there. And that's where most of my kind of friends were, people that I knew. But I also used to travel over to Green quite a lot and occasionally to Orange to visit people. So sometimes we got invited to dinner there or we invited people to dinner. So I think there was a lot of back and forth of people visiting the gates, but I actually stayed at Blue Gate.
Right. And so you were living in London when you left Ireland. Did you, because I know there were a lot of Greenham support groups around the country, and at one point, well, for quite a while, there was a Greenham London office. Were you involved in any of that end of it?
Yeah. I used to go and visit the Greenham office occasionally, and sometimes there was collections of things like Gore-Texes or blankets, or so those of us working would chip in, and, you know, sometimes we would just scout around the charity shops and get stuff. Or sometimes we would just give money to people who went out and got it. So, yeah, we were involved in quite a lot of the collecting for, you know, food as well. So we sent up our soya products down there and our money to buy soya milk and that type of thing. So, yeah, we were quite involved in that side of it to make sure that Greenham could financially keep going, really.
Yeah, I remember there would be benefit concerts as well.
Yes, yeah.
For fundraising and consciousness raising as well, yes. Really, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So you used to travel down in your own van or vehicle.
Yeah, sometimes with other people. So we'd all share and I'd go in somebody else's vehicle. And then later on, I used to go in my own.
Right. So what was your favourite thing about being at camp?
I think for me, I was very political from an early age. I was very worried about the environment from an early age. And I felt that nobody was listening. And so I kind of like felt that there was a kindred spirit of people who actually took the environment seriously and took the whole nuclear thing seriously and just been with, you know, like-minded people, because I think a lot of the time in Ireland, you feel like you're a lone voice or that, you know, there aren't that many people who think like you. And so you feel very alone. And so it was just really nice to be involved with people who had the same kind of politics or the same, you know, ideas. I mean, obviously, you know, we all had our slight differences, but generally we kind of had the same idea that we wanted a peaceful world. We didn't want a world full of, you know, patriarchal wars.
Oh, that's interesting, because you were brought up in the Republic of Ireland, and yeah. Ireland was a country of neutrality
yeah.
in your childhood.
Yeah. It was a country of neutrality, but in the war, like in the world wars, but every single day on the news, you had images of the troubles, what we call the troubles. So it was the troubles of between the Catholics and Protestants in the north. And so you grew up all the time with this war, you know, and hatred between people. And so it really did invade your psyche quite a lot.
Yeah.
And I think when you belong to a country that's had a past of famine and, you know, a past of having been oppressed or, you know, you do have more of an idea what it might be like for people that it's happening to now, because you've had the stories that passed down from grandparents and all that type of thing, you know. And I was very much didn't want nuclear, any kind of nuclear in Ireland. And I can remember one of the first actions I did, you know, the first one I was old enough to go to was the one at Carrinsore Point, where they tried to build a nuclear facility in Carrinsore Point. And thousands of us just went there. We just dropped everything that we were doing and we just went there, and we got all these famous musicians to play day and night and day, and have this endless concert until they, you know, just left. And basically we just drove them out.
Oh, what county was Carrinsore Point in?
Carrinsore Point is in Wexford. But they wanted to build a nuclear facility there. And so we just all went there.
And that was for nuclear power?
It was to build a nuclear power station, and we didn't want it, basically.
Yeah,
so it never got built. Bulldozers just up and left one day. They just got fed up because they knew we weren't going to leave.
Yeah, so for me, my first involvement of being anti-nuclear was to do with nuclear power, and then made the connection with nuclear weapons.
Mm.
So the nuclear weapons thing came to you when you got to London?
Yes.
Right. So
I think at the time I'd done a lot of research. I joined Friends of the Earth very, very young, at like 14 or 15. I was aware of, you know, all the different things that were happening, and very concerned about, you know, all of the waste that comes from the nuclear facilities, and that there isn't enough lead on the whole planet to actually, you know, encase it. And what would happen when it all leaks, and, you know, over hundreds and hundreds of years, what was going to happen with all that waste?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to ask you again, what was your favourite thing about actually being at camp?
I think meeting like-minded people. That was the most important thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Just having people that you could talk to about it, that didn't think you were just some boring hippie talking about rubbish. They just wanted to talk about fashion or something, you know?
Yeah. But you weren't drawn to going to a mixed camp.
I think for me, I had, because Carrinsore Point was mixed, and I had gone to mixed camps as well, like Aldermaston and other things, and Fastlay, lots of other things. But there was a different energy about a women-only camp, you know. And I did find that with the mixed camps, the men talked over you. They, you know, made you second place. They tried to take over. The women's voices were just getting lost. And so for me, that was what I liked about Greenham, was the fact that women could be themselves, and that women tried to bring out the ones that were quiet and kind of give you encouragement to be involved.
And what about the things you liked least being at camp?
The ship pits. I didn't like them. I was always afraid that I would fall in.
Okay. Well, that didn't take much answering then, did it?
No, that's very definitely was a bit I didn't like, which is why I ended up getting my own vehicle in the end with my own nice toilet in it.
So did you take part in any of the big actions or smaller ones? Did you go into the base?
I went into the base. I danced on the silos. I've been involved in, a lot of stuff like that. Yeah, not just at Greenham, but yes, at Greenham I did go into the base, yeah. Because obviously I did actions at other camps as well, like Aldermaston and Menwith Hill. But at Greenham, I did go in there and take part in many of the actions. I didn't do any of the publicity stuff. So when people came to interview people at camp, I withdrew and didn't get involved in anything that would put your name in the paper because of my I was in a custody battle at the time. So that was why.
All right. Okay. Yeah. For some women, it was important to not get your name in the paper because of their work.
Yeah.
Because of their jobs.
Yeah,
because
of my job and also because of my kids, because it was very difficult being a lesbian and coming from Ireland and having to run and be in exile from your country. And I was still at that point hoping that I'd, win custody, but that wasn't to be. Did lots of actions, but kept kind of in the background. So I was quite careful. So if I got arrested, I gave a wrong name, that type of thing.
Oh, yeah. Did you go into Newbury much? How did you feel that the relationship was with the local residents?
Well, the local pub was very, aggressive towards us. But some of the people in Newbury itself were okay. Like the Quakers were very friendly and very helpful and often would let you have a shower or, they would, help you out in lots of different ways. They were very, very decent people. But some of the other residents could be quite hostile. Right. We got a mixture of both, I think. Some people were saying, oh, it's great what you're doing up there. And other people would say, you're going to get rid of all our jobs if you get rid of that base. And, so people had different attitudes.
Yeah. And what about the, what did you feel that the main sort of mass media have portrayed Greenham? I mean, one of the things that I feel is that it did change. Over the years, the hostility changed once Cruz had left, because you carried on coming down after Cruz left.
Yeah, it did. I found that most of the right-wing papers, denigrated us. Some of the left-wing press was a bit more positive, and the kind of independent ones give kind of like a bit of a mixture of views. So it depended on the actual publications. Some of them were quite positive. Mm. But some of them were just like, oh, they're all filthy women there, but actually that wasn't the case. People were very obsessive about the cleanliness and in some of the, with the food and everything, So it's like if people's view can be very distorted, You might look a bit muddy because you're living in the mud, but you might still be very clean.
Some more than others, I think, Sarah.
Yeah, I think so. I think I was definitely fussy about the cleanliness.
Same here. That's why I got a van.
Yeah, me too. Some of the local shops were quite happy to, I think it was the Tesco's, as far as I can remember, that we used to go up to. And they started to get in all our special foods that we used to like the Tafuti ice creams from America and, all the vegan products,
Yeah.
They did do that. And they were quite amenable that way.
Did you have much experience of evictions? It was one of the...
The evictions were quite traumatic sometimes. before I had a vehicle, I can remember it was really, really difficult because we were trying to pile maybe six people's stuff into a tiny car and just try and get as, you know, salvage as many things as we could. And, you know, they were so rough with us. And, you know, they kind of made a point of trying to destroy or damage your property. You know, this was kind of like part of the intimidation, wasn't it? To try and ruin your stuff so that you'd have no heat, no, you know, so people's, you know, the things they needed the most to keep them warm and dry, they would make a point of destroying or, you know, making sure they didn't get those things back so women would get cold. And, you know, I thought that was quite horrible.
Mm.
And how fast you had to go, you know, it was so quick.
Mm.
Like, you know, you had to be on the ball and get everything so quickly. So it was quite impossible.
Yeah.
And just things like, you know, if you were ill or, you know, had a disability or anything, the way they often put people into the cells and didn't give them their tablets, which was, I thought, very mean, because some people were dependent on those tablets for their you know, comfort or, you know, pain levels and that type of thing.
Mm.
You know, even people that were diabetic, I mean, they could have gone into a coma. And people did have serious effects sometimes after the arrests.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it was just the inhumane way that people got treated.
Yeah.
Not by all of them, mind you. We did have one or two. There was one or two women in the base that were quite friendly and sometimes gave us warning.
What do you think is the main, not personal legacy, but the legacy of Greenham today? What do you think the legacy of Greenham is? Or several, you know, there might be several examples.
Mm. I think the legacy is to show that, you know, women can get together and women have got a voice and women can be powerful, and that, yeah, change takes a long, long, long time. Change is not fast. And sometimes, you know, slow kind of actions and slow things that happen over time eventually starts to infiltrate into the general population. I mean, yes, at the time we were probably a very minority voice, but I think now, I think a lot more people are more worried about the environment than they were back then. I mean, I can remember as a child when we were learning about plastics in school and how great they were and all these Tupperware things that were going to be made and, you know, and how great it was for keeping food safe and all this type of thing. And I can remember asking the question, and I think I can't remember what age I was, maybe nine or something. And I said, but if it doesn't break down and it's that durable, when it becomes rubbish, where is it all going to end up on the planet? So like in 50 or 60 years time, if people keep making all this plastic, where's it going to go? Like, is the world going to turn into a big dump? And I was told to shut up and stop being so stupid. But now it's funny because some of the older people are saying to me, how did you know all those years ago that the oceans would be covered in plastic and the land would be covered in plastic and everything would be covered in plastic? But I mean, lots of people knew that, but it's just that nobody was listening to us,
mm.
you know. But it's like the same with the nuclear thing. You know, we were saying, well, where's all the waste going to be? Well, now there are fields in America that are miles and miles and miles of drums of nuclear waste. I mean, as far as the eye can see. I mean, and they're all leaking. They're in these concrete barrels and they are leaking into the environment. It's very worrying.
Yeah, in fact, this just in the last week, we've heard that at Fukushima, they're going to release a lot of radioactive seawater that they've contained, and they're going to dump it in the sea. They actually don't know what to do with it. And that's just the water.
Yeah.
It is quite worrying.
very worrying. I mean, even like off the Pembrokeshire coast, which is supposed to be a national place of, you know, preservation and everything, the technetium levels in the sea, like, you know, crustaceans and that, are really, really high, and people are eating that. People are eating that food, that fish. Yeah. And people don't know about these things, you know, unless you sort of tell people, they're not aware of it.
Mm.
You know, already our bodies are probably full of plastic and radiation from all of these things.
Mm.
You know, so this is why is that, you know, I think all of the women there, they wanted to create a better world for the future people. They wanted to stop all of this happening and to make people more aware. But I think, you know, all of the voices, like maybe Greenham was just one voice in a mass of other voices that were also, you know, shouting about the environment and David Attenborough's programs and lots of other things. But I think it was important that there was a women's aspect and a women's voice in there, that it wasn't just like men's perspective. Mm. And that's what was different about Greenham, is that you got women's perspective.
A lot of there were a vast range of motivations that got women involved. And one of them was, for a lot of women, was a religious motivation. I mean, and that's everything from Buddhism, Pax Christi, the Quakers, but also the sort of more emerging goddess, Mother Earth, sort of neo-feminist pagan. I don't know.
People's spiritual beliefs were very important in it, I think. And, you know, it was very inclusive because we had women from all different beliefs, didn't we? It wasn't just any one set of beliefs. There was lots of the pagan and the goddess thing, you know, but there was lots of other women that turned up as well from all over the world with all different types of faiths and beliefs. But it was the one thing that could gel people together, because in all of their faiths, there seemed to be this one thing where they wanted to protect the planet. You know, it was important for their spiritual belief that they were doing something to make a difference. And I think people were trying their hardest to be inclusive, weren't they? It was the days when, you know, people were kind of like thinking, we don't want exclusive, we want to be inclusive.
Wow. Mm. I don't think that was quite seen at the time. I think we were seen as quite exclusive because we wanted to be women only.
Yeah,
I mean, that was a question that I just got so fed up with having to answer. You know, why can't men come? Why can't men come? Men did come in.
Well, actually, there was men at the very beginning, but a woman got attacked, and that was why it happened at the very beginning. But obviously, I don't want to go into that because it's that woman's privacy. But that is actually what happened. The men were taking over, and they attacked one of the women sexually.
Oh,
yes, that was at the very beginning. But obviously, you know, those of us that knew kept that quiet because of that woman's privacy.
Yeah.
And so that was a lot of the reasoning why it then became women only, because it wasn't safe with the men there.
Mm.
And it needed to be a safe space for women. And also because women wanted, I remember as well, speaking to some of the women who were there at the beginning, and the women were saying that they wanted it to be non-violent, and the men didn't. And so that was another reason why it was women only, because of the non-violent action. The women seemed to all want it to be non-violent, but not all of the men did. They were quite happy to be violent.
Interaction that we had with men as women for peace was obviously with the bailiffs and the police, but Thames Valley Police, but also the actual squaddies, and some women, sometimes from a religious conviction, would make a point of talking through the fence to the the squaddies and others didn't. How did you feel about that? Did you do that?
I didn't talk to, I just was one of the people who didn't talk to them through the fence. I mean, yeah, there was one or two of the women there that spoke to us. And if they were, you know, trying to warn us about an eviction, then yeah, I'd speak to them. But I didn't see that there was any point trying to convert them because they weren't interested. They were working there. If they were working there, they definitely weren't going to be seeing our point of view. And I didn't want to waste my voice on people who weren't going to hear it. I'd rather, you know, put my voice somewhere where it was going to be actually heard. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. You have to sort of think to yourself, you know, these people may change their mind by our example, watching our example, but they're certainly not going to change their mind by being preached to or talked to. And sometimes, you know, you can inspire, move, and, you know, encourage people just by your example. You don't have to even say anything. Do you see what I mean? I think people have different ways, don't they?
Mm.
But I've never found that preaching really works. Or, you know, these kind of people like the squaddies, they're so adamant in their way of thinking, you know, and they were very much in like their way of thinking was sort of, you know, it's a dog eat dog world and you need to be, you know, weaponed up to the hilt to be ready for somebody else coming along with weapons up to the hilt. That was their view of the world and no one was ever going to change that view.
Yeah. And I never made a point of talking to the squaddies, but no. I know women, some of the women that did, and they found that, you know, the squaddies had been in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
They, you know, they trained at Greenham and sent them out to Northern Ireland.
Yes, that's right.
So that, you know, that might be even more of a reason why you couldn't be bothered to, you know, entertain, put your energy into them.
No, I just felt that my energies were better used in other directions, like oftentimes advertising Greenham. So, yeah, you know, like you said, in the office in London, we did a lot of fundraising for Greenham, and not just fundraising, but also getting people interested in what the women were doing there, you know, letting other groups, liaising with other groups to let other groups know what was going on. So even if they didn't want to go to Greenham, they were still interested in doing other things that were going to be, you know, lobbying against nuclear power and weapons and stuff like that, you know, making people aware of what was happening to the Shoshone people, making people aware of what was happening at Aldermass and what kind of weapons were there. And many of us did follow the Trident as well for a while, didn't we? Like we left Greenough and followed the Trident for a bit and came back again and were involved in Aldermaston and Men with Hill. So a lot of the stuff I did was going between the different camps. So I might have been at Faslane, then at Menwith, then at Greenham, then at Aldermaston, and taking part in lots of different actions. So Greenham was one part of that.
Yeah, that's the Greenham Women Are Everywhere.
Yes.
The wider web.
Yeah. And a lot of people don't know that Greenham Women were involved in a lot of other things. So like involved in feeding the miners that were on strike, for example. And they were often involved in things like, you know, bringing toys and clothes and trying to highlight what was happening in Romanian orphanages, sending food out to other countries, you know, sending tampons and sanitary products to women in war zones. You know, there was lots of spin-off things that people knew nothing about. And we did a lot of fundraising for those kind of things to help women out in places like that. You know, sending hundreds of sponges, for example, because they had nowhere to dump their sanitary towels. So, you know, things that they could use that were useful for them.
Mm.
You know, products, you know, medicines even.
Yeah.
And liaising with people like, you know, there were lots of women that were involved in Medicine Sans Frontier and other organizations that we gave money to as well. And that was a lot of Greenham women that got involved in that after the Greenham thing ended.
One of the things, you know, that impacted for on women was the zapping, and I think now, you know, there's some more sense of post-traumatic stress disorder, which obviously some of the squaddies were being affected by, but well, the zapping as well. Do you have any comments on the zapping?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I didn't experience it myself. I didn't feel zapped. But lots of people I knew got ME, said they felt like they were zapped. There was definitely a lot of women that had that experience. And I just think we all are built differently neurologically. I'm actually autistic, which may be why I didn't feel the zapping in the same way. But it did affect my health. I did get a virus. I got transverse myelitis. I don't know whether it was related to Greenham. The doctors think that the lesion in my spine and the virus I got in my spine may be connected to radiation, but they can't be sure. But lots and there were some women that did a survey of all of the, you know, why Newbury was the most amazing town in the whole of England that had the best disabled access of anywhere at that time when nowhere else did. And it was because there was such high levels of disabled people. It was like something like 20 times the national average. And there had to be some reason why that triangle between Greenham, Aldermaston and Burfield had this triangle of a huge increase of cancers, people with neurological disorders and all of these things. And we were trying to find out why. And then eventually we did get an answer that in 1959, there had been one of the planes crashed with one of the bombs on it and the radiation leaked. And this would be an explanation why people would get ill. But I mean, obviously, the zapping is a different matter. And, you know, people do believe it, that this is what happened to them. And I'm sure, you know, somebody needs to do some scientific research into it, because, you know, it's too many people saying it for it to be just a coincidence. You know, and I don't know why some people were more susceptible than others. I don't know whether drinking alcohol made you more susceptible, whether, you know, smoking dope made you more susceptible, whether the food you ate made you more susceptible, whether your genetics made you more susceptible. But there was definitely a lot of women who experienced it, but I didn't experience it.
Right. So there was a nuclear plane in 1959?
Yes. And it crashed with the bomb in it on at Greenham when it was landing. There was an accident.
I remember about the accident. I wasn't aware that it was nuclear. Wow.
Yeah. So they covered it up, obviously. They had to admit it eventually, but it was 50 years later they admitted it or something.
Yeah. And Aldermaston, which was an atomic weapons establishment, was research and development. We discovered at Aldermaston camp eventually that there was a big leukemia cluster around the Aldermaston.
Yeah, there was.
Place.
Huge.
And that's why we only camped one weekend a month at Aldermaston.
Mm. Yeah.
Aldermaston's still going up at camp, the women's camp. It's still going on.
Yeah, it's still there.
Have you been back at all recently?
I don't go now because of my health. It's too risky to be around the radiation because of my spinal issues. So that's why I had to stop going. It wasn't because I didn't agree with the politics anymore or any other reason. It was purely for my health.
Yeah.
I think a lot of women have to stop going because the effects were so bad. I don't know whether it's because of my autism. My neurological system is very badly affected by things. And so I didn't want to take the risk.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I still are supporting them in other ways, obviously, encouraging and supporting and doing other things. But I think sometimes you have to sort of say to yourself, if you've got, you know, people that are dependent on you or people that are going to be affected by your death, if you have an early death, you know, how much are you willing to put yourself at risk?
Definitely.
I think as a youngster, you kind of don't think too much about that. You're firing in there and you think, well, if I'm at risk, I'm at risk. But as an older person, you become more aware than as the effects of these things, you know, and the pain levels and everything gets worse, and you become, you know, it's not as easy when you're older.
Yeah, definitely. Did you go on any of the peace tours? They stopped off at Fast Lane and Memwith.
Yeah,
I
dipped in and out of them because I was working. So obviously they moved around. So sometimes I would have to take a train at the weekend or drive up at the weekend and join them for a bit. So I might have, like, you know, driven up on a Friday night, gone to Fast Lane for a bit, joined the peace tour for like the weekend and then come back again. Or joined for a day, you know, sometimes I did bits like that, or met up with people in places at times when I was on holiday. But I couldn't do the whole tour because I was working. Usually. And there was a limit to how many days I could get off.
Yeah.
So a lot of us had to do that. We had to dip in and out of things rather than do the whole tour. So join it for a day or join it for a weekend or, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, the first two were on bicycles anyway.
Yeah, I can remember, I mean, obviously your memory starts to fade, but I can remember being at Fast Lane and I can remember being in groups and I can remember, actually, I do remember one time borrowing a bicycle to do a part of some trip. And had to borrow one. We were doing two things at the same time at Fast Lane. I can remember, so we might have been doing a bit of an action in the morning and borrow somebody's bike to be in part of the peace tour. But then we were giving out food to the miners later in the afternoon. So we had this huge drive to do to somewhere, you know. So there was a lot of things that we were involved in, wasn't there?
Yeah, there certainly was.
So we might have been doing soup in the afternoon and cycling in the morning or walking on a march in the morning and doing something else in the afternoon or at another action somewhere else. Or we were in court because of something we did further back. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I did get in the paper for some of those things where somebody snapped me and I was trying to hide my face. Somebody got me, been dragged into the police station or dragged out or something, or winning a court case or something like that. I was trying to be very, you know, not noticed.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'll say this because I know that you're quite an artist, and I wonder if you have much personal archives around of photographs and drawings and stuff.
I have got photographs which I've sent to the Greenham website. But one sad thing I didn't record was the fabulous banners that we all did and the fabulous artwork that we did. I don't know where it all went or what happened to it all. But I can remember, like, all of us being involved in making banners. And, you know, this went right on after Greenham. You know, I can remember being at WIT a few years ago and we were all sewing things, you know, on for the trident, you know, made a huge trident banner with all kinds of amazing fish and everything and got all the kids. And I can remember doing lots and lots of workshops at different camps, like, I can't even remember the name, half the camps, but Camp With No Name and QPC and lots of other camps, Rainbow Circles, where women got into little groups and did things. And some of these were Greenham women, you know, women that were at Greenham, but then they were involved in other things. And they would have like a workshop where people could join in and make things for the Trident banner or whatever, or another piece banner or whatever. These are the things I remember, these beautiful, colourful amazing creations that people made and how they put their creativity into expressing how they felt. Much better to do something like that than to do it with violence.
Yeah.
I think women have a different way of their voice. It's not just their physical voice. And I think a lot of women like to put a lot of creativity into the way that they're trying to get across their message. And I think that was one of the things that I loved about working in women-only groups, is that to see the different ways that women cooperate with their creativity to create something amazing like that. And that was one of those things, wasn't it? That rainbow circle. And again, it was about the trying to be, I mean, didn't always succeed, I have to say, but the trying to get there, trying to be inclusive and to think about tribal communities and women in other communities that, you know, whose lives matter too, who might not be able to get there, or who these things are affecting in different ways. So, you know, we learned a lot of things about, you know, how difficult it is to make things inclusive sometimes. Mm. You know, when you're trying to make it inclusive for one lot of people, it excludes another lot of people. And how do you make something totally inclusive? It's very, very hard. Hence why I think there was lots of different gates for different kinds of women, you know?
Yeah, that's commented on quite a lot, the different characters of the different gates.
Yeah.
And
like for some of the gates I found quite difficult. Like, you know, I quite liked Blue and Green Gate, and I used to go to Orange Gate to visit quite often. But I did find Yellow Gate quite hard to cope with. Maybe it was my autism, I don't know, but I did find it quite hard to cope with. Some women, I think, found, you know, the sort of characters of one gate more difficult than another.
Have you been back at all since it is a common?
I've been back and driven past and had a look at it, you know, going somewhere else, and maybe got out for a few minutes just to reminisce a bit and remember and look at how different it is. I mean, you'd hardly recognize it now, would you? It's so different. It's like you think, no, that can't be Blue Gate. Oh my God, it is, you know. And of course, Green Gate is just totally different. It's just like a woodland. I mean, it just doesn't look anything like it used to look, did it? I am in contact with some of the women, you know, or sometimes they pop up in another group that I'm doing or something that I've gone to, it's something else. But yes, quite a lot of them have passed on as well, which is sad.
Like, yep. Some of the older ones, that's been, sometimes that's been the reunion point, actually, a funeral.
Yeah, it's very sad. Because I can remember, sometimes I've forgotten their names, but I remember their faces. Like there was this woman that was the most amazing poet, and she used to go to Aldermaston as well. And I can never remember her name, to look her up to see if she...
Hazel.
And she was the most fantastic poet. And I think, where can you get her poetry? I would love to, because she was so creative and wonderful. And she kept us all, like, enthralled with her poetry, didn't she?
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a CD of her reading some poems.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. It would be amazing if we could somehow get it on to these IT things where everybody could read them and have copies of these things.
Well, on the Green and Women Everywhere website, they are compiling more and more of this stuff. But it's up to us to be giving them the stuff, and for, you know, actually there's a lot of research going on now because of the 40th anniversary. One of the things that I've noticed is how few younger people have ever heard of Greenham.
I know, I'm shocked. I do notice there seems to be a wave, you know, things go in waves. And in our time during the 80s and 90s, there seemed to be much more of a wave of left-wing thinking. I don't mean extreme left-wing, but more kind of thinking about inclusivity and challenging the way things are, the status quo about, you know, do people want to live in this status quo even, you know? So, you know, we weren't thinking, oh, you know, we want all gay people to get married. We were thinking, well, the whole institution of marriage needs to be gone. You know, the whole idea of forcing people that they have to be, have a piece of paper to be valuable in this world. And now it's like the younger people are going back to more the whole right wing thing. Oh, well, we want all these traditional, you know, conservative type of things like marriage and all this. You know, it's like almost they're gone the complete opposite circle to where we were at. Do you see what I mean? We were challenging the whole idea, weren't we? Oh, you know, there isn't only one kind of relationship, which is married 2.3 kids. You know, there's all kinds of different ways that people can have relationships. Do you know what I mean? But that seems to have got lost somehow.
Yeah, into the conformity.
Yeah, younger people are much more conformist.
Yeah.
I find, anyway. I think we were very daring, weren't we?
It does feel like that.
And very stoic. I think I get a bit disillusioned and sad when, you know, I think of all the hard work that people put into all of these things, and then younger people are sometimes so uneducated that they don't even know about any of the stuff that's happening. I think what is, you know, there's something wrong with the education system. I mean, we thought that with the invention of computers and the internet and